Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 882. Machiavelli, The Perfect Storm, Machiavelli 3.0, and the Rise of Global Fascism. This is being recorded on December 18th of the year 2015. In this program, we're going to be focusing in a considerable measure on four op-ed columns which appeared on successive days in, of all publications, the New York Times, the Gray Lady, which also, not incidentally, is the CIA's number one propaganda asset. What is remarkable is that, again, on successive days, a week ago, December 11th, a Friday, and on the following day, Saturday, December 12th, the New York Times featured four op-ed columns basically dealing with political reaction and fascism in particular. The columns vary in insight. What I think is notable is that when the New York Times is taking note of the rise of fascism in America, you can be bloody well sure that the bathtub is overflowing. I want to stress at the outset that I think it is important to take note of these successive columns. I also think it is important to note that the analysis presented here is predictably superficial. Nowhere in the columns will you see any mention of the fact that many of the world's most powerful corporations and associated political elites were very supportive of fascism. Nowhere will you see anything about the eugenics programs that were implemented and how they too were rooted in mainstream intellectual trends in the West. Sort of the standard analysis of fascism in the U.S. and elsewhere is that, you know, once upon a time, there were a couple of very bad men named Hitler and Mussolini and also the Emperor of Japan, and they hypnotized everybody and made them all go crazy, and then they had a bad war, but along came the Allies and everything was wonderful, or would have been wonderful, but along came another bad man named Joseph Stalin, and he hypnotized all the Russians and made them all go crazy. That is a fundamentally inadequate analysis of fascism. We certainly don't have the time to go into an in-depth analysis here. That is why the SpitfireList.com website exists, and that is why the old anti-fascist books, which will give you some very, very good depth, historical depth on just what fascism was, what it came from, and what happened to the forces that gave rise to it. Basically, they remained very much in power and did not miss a beat. We will be talking in particular in this program about a very important insight that Peter Lavenda had and that is part and parcel to the analysis here. We spoke with Peter Lavenda in, For the Record, programs 837 through 838 rather through 847, focusing on the Hitler legacy, and then in, For the Record, 864 and 865. We came back to Peter Lavenda about the Hitler legacy and other things. The longing for a mythical, idealized past that never really existed is something that many different strains of fascism have in common. And we're going to be talking about that. There has been a great deal of hot air wafted about by various people, Donald Trump has garnered a lot of ink about his political rhetoric and proposed political agenda. And we have also, of course, heard a great deal about ISIS. I would note something. This program, again, the title, The Perfect Storm, Machiavelli 3.0 and the Rise of Global Fascism. And we are going to be talking about not only the idealized past, but also how, in a sense, the European and American fascists and reactionaries that have been pointing to ISIS and going, see, look at those Muslims. You know, I mean, they're terrible. We got to keep them out of the country. Trump is saying, and others now are saying, oh, Trump is so un-American, which is really hypocritical. And the same tone is being sounded in Europe with everybody from the Front National in France to the Sweden Democrats being bankrolled by Carl Lundstrom, who also bankrolled the Pirate Bay website that hosted WikiLeaks. And all of the good progressives went and visited that site. That site not only bankrolled by one of the Europe's top fascists and the fellow who was bankrolling the Sweden Democrats, who are the Swedish political party who are minting valuable political coinage from an anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim xenophobia. But that website, the Pirate Bay website, was patronized by some people with very advanced internet and hacking skills. And for those of you who visited that, you don't suppose, do you, that maybe, I mean, just maybe they were doing some data mining? Well, of course they were. But, you know, that's life in the big city, isn't it? What is so interesting is that ISIS also, and there is every indication that they are derived from the Muslim Brotherhood at one level, and that they are the direct outgrowth of a covert operation, as we looked at in For the Record 880, that is being backed by CIA, or some elements of CIA, and also by Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Once again, Islam is being used as a proxy warrior force against not only Shia, but also particularly against Russia and China. However, when that Frankenstein's monster began to move into Iraq, reversing the, quote, gains, unquote, from our altogether misguided adventure, then we wound up, now we are going to war once again with a force that we helped to create. And we've talked about that many times. For the Record, 880 goes into that. There are even some screenshots from a declassified DIA memorandum talking about ISIS and how it grew out, once again, like Al-Qaeda, like the Taliban, from a covert operation undertaken by the underground Reich faction of our intelligence service and others. And the use of Muslims as proxy warriors is once again biting back upon us. ISIS as well is not only manifesting a desire, a preoccupation with and a desire to return to an idealized past, but they are bouncing off of the reactionaries in the West, Donald Trump, people like the Sweden Democrats, Marine Le Pen, and the Front National in France. And I called this Machiavelli 3.0. This is a direct supplement to For the Record 830. And that was subtitled Machiavelli 2.0. The very Islamic Muslim Brotherhood Frankenstein's monster that we have created is now attacking in Europe and the U.S. And this is fueling political reaction as well, to the great delight of people like Donald Trump and others. Quoting from the description for the Record 830, I noted, and this is a direct quote, European fascists of the National Front variety can point to the attacks. These were the Paris attacks on Charlie Hebdo in January and say, See, we told you so. You can't trust these, and fill in the blanks, Muslims, immigrants, Muslim immigrants, etc. We are your only hope. Join with us. And at the same time, the Muslim Brotherhood, ISIS, and Islamic fascists of their ilk, and the Muslim Brotherhood is an Islamic fascist organization. It was allied with the Axis in World War II, were then used as anti-communist cadre during the Cold War by MI6, BND, and CIA. And they have been used as proxy warriors, and their corporatist economics endears them to the transnational corporations. And just as, again, the European fascists and the likes of Donald Trump are saying, see, we told you, you can't trust these, again, fill in the blanks, Muslim immigrants, etc. We are your only hope. Join with us. By the same token, the Islamic fascists are saying, see, we told you so, you can't trust these infidels. We are your only hope. Join with us. So it is the perfect storm. And indeed, we have people on the right wing saying that we've got to once again send troops into the Middle East. That is exactly what ISIS is hoping for. And believe me, they must be dancing in the aisles, although they may frown upon dancing as being corrupt, at the rise of the likes of Donald Trump. There is nothing that they would like better than for the U.S. to once again send troops on a large scale into the Middle East. So again, bearing in mind that the New York Times is very much like Inspector Raynaud in the movie Casablanca, they're shocked to learn that there's gambling going on in this establishment. Once again, I think it is a bellwether of no small proportions that, again, on successive days, Friday, December 11th of 2015, and the following day, Saturday, December 12th of 2015, the op-ed page of the Gray Lady featured two columns each day dealing with the phenomenon of fascism. It should also be noted that poverty and economic deprivation and the social dislocation that goes with that also is helping to fuel the willingness to scapegoat the other, whoever that might be. A New York Times blog, this is not one of the four op-ed columns I have in mind, but Paul Krugman of the New York Times, in his Conscience of a Liberal blog on December 7th of 2015, had a column titled "The That 30s Show," which reads in part, "A few years ago, DePromed, Eichen Green, and O'Rourke looked at the determinants of right-wing extremism in the 1930s. They found that economic factors mattered a lot. Specifically, what mattered was not the current growth of the economy, but cumulative growth, or more to the point, the depth of the cumulative recession. 1 year of contraction was not enough to significantly boost extremism. In other words, but a depression that persisted for years." Again, 1 year of contraction was not enough to significantly boost extremism. In other words, but a depression that persisted for years was. I would note, then, for the record, 412, done in June of 2003, I specifically I said that the Bush administration and the underground Reich and corporatist forces behind it specifically intended to wreck the train, as I put it, to produce a fiscal train wreck, which in turn would serve as a justification for getting rid of Social Security or gutting Social Security and Medicare. And that is exactly what happened, and that is what they are trying to do. Continuing with that 30s show from Paul Krugman. "And now the National Front," that's the Front National, "has scored a first-place finish in regional elections in France and will probably take a couple of regions in the second round. Economics isn't the only factor. Immigration, refugees, and terrorism play into the mix as well. But Europe's underperformance is slowly eroding the legitimacy not just of the European project, but of the open society itself. And in many, many shows, I have alluded to what I call von Clausewitzian economics, the continuation of war by other means. And again, you don't need to drop bombs on people or shell them or shoot them. You squeeze them economically, deny them proper nutrition, proper housing, proper clothing, proper health care, proper education, and they're going to die just as surely. But beyond that, before they die, they're going to get mean as hell. And that is what is happening, not just in Europe, but in the U.S. as well.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
The New York Times of Saturday, December 12th of 2015 featured a column by Timothy Egan, Goose Steppers in the GOP. This reads in part as follows. Well, he's got the Hitler vote. The neo-Nazi website Daily Stormer was out and proud earlier this week. Heil Donald Trump, the ultimate savior. After endorsing the Republican presidential frontrunner earlier this year for his call to deport 11 million Mexican immigrants, the fomenters of American fascism have now added an apt twist to his slogan, one not far from the truth of the campaign. Make America white again. Nazis, I hate these guys. Oh, but they're a tiny minority of pink-faced malcontents living in basements with the windows taped up. Everybody hates them. Add to that supporters of the Ku Klux Klan who thrown in with Trump as well. David Duke, a former Grand Wizard of the Klan, liked everything he heard from Trump this week, embracing him for standing up for white nationalism. And sure, all the little Hitlers probably don't amount to a hill of beans. But what about the 35% of Republican voters in the New York Times CBS News poll who say they're all in with the man being Sieg Heil by aspiring brown shirts and men in white sheets? I'm going to butt in what he should have said, as they are being sieg-heiled by men in white shirts and three-piece suits in corporate suites in places like New York and the City of London and Berlin and elsewhere, because that has always been the case with fascism, as well as, of course, the brown shirts and the so-called street fascists, to coin the term, who are the fodder at which people like Trump aim. Continuing with Timothy Egan's column from December 12, 2015, in the New York Times, of all papers, Goose Steppers in the GOP. It's a very ugly political moment, but there it is. The Republican Party is now home to millions of people who would throw out the Constitution, welcome a police state against Latinos and Muslims, and enforce a religious test for entry into a country built by people fleeing religious persecution. This stuff polls well in their party, even if the Bill of Rights does not. Trump's proposal, a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the U.S., is not just flotsam from the lunatic fringe. Well, it is, but the fringe is huge. Early polls show a plurality of Republican voters agree with Trump on banning all Muslims, and many would go even further. Quote, add in every other kind of immigrant, and it's perfect, tweeted Ann Coulter, who sells xenophobia as a mean girl provocateur with many friends in the far-right media universe. Trump himself doesn't seem to care about comparisons to the buffoonish Mussolini, the truly scary, the evil one admired by the Daily Stormer, or the fictional, worse than Voldemort, as J.K. Rowling tweeted. He sloughed off the fascism talk by associating his proposal with the internment in America of the Japanese during World War II. There's a winning thought. I was wondering when he was going to get around to alienating Asian Americans, the highest earning, best educated, and fastest growing racial group in the U.S., according to the Pew Foundation. To review, he started with the blacks through his smear campaign on the citizenship of the nation's first African-American president. Moved on to Mexicans, war veterans, women who look less than flawless and middle-aged, the disabled, all Muslims, and now people whose grandparents were rousted from their American homes and put in camps. Which gets us back to his base and their awful bedfellows in the neo-Nazi bunkers. Who are these people? His supporters, most of them, do not see the shadow of the Reich when they look in the mirror. They are white, lower middle class, with little education beyond high school. The global economy has run them over. They don't recognize their country, and they need a villain. And the previous day, that was December 11th of 2015, Paul Krugman had a column empowering the ugliness about some of the same dynamic. We live in an era of political news that is all too often shocking, but not surprising. Again, he's shocked. He damn well shouldn't be. Continuing, the rise of Donald Trump definitely falls into that category. And so does the electoral earthquake that struck France in Sunday's regional elections, with the right-wing National Front winning more votes than either of the major mainstream parties. Parenthetically, they then combined in the follow-up election to prevent the Front National from winning any regions. However, they may very well succeed in months or years to come. Continuing with Krugman's column, again from the day before the Timothy Egan column. What do these events have in common? Both involve political figures tapping into the resentments of a bloc of xenophobic and or racist voters who have been there all along. The good news is that such voters are a minority. The bad news is that it's a pretty big minority on both sides of the Atlantic. If you were wondering where the support for Mr. Trump or Marine Le Pen, the head of the National Front, is coming from, you just haven't been paying attention. But why are most of these voters making themselves heard so loudly now? Have they become so much more numerous? Maybe, but it's not clear. More important, I'd argue, is the way the strategies elites have traditionally used to keep a lid on those angry voters have finally broken down. Let me start with what is happening in Europe, both because it's probably less familiar to American readers and because it is, in a way, a simpler story than what is happening here. My European friends will no doubt say that I'm oversimplifying, but from an American perspective, it looks as if Europe's establishment has tried to freeze the xenophobic right not just out of political power, but out of any role in acceptable discourse. To be a respectable European politician, whether of the right or the left, you have had to accept the European project of ever closer union, of free movement of people, of open borders, and harmonized regulations. This leaves no room for right-wing nationalists, even though right-wing nationalism has always had substantial popular support. What the European establishment may not have realized, however, is that its ability to define the limits of discourse rests on the perception that it knows what it is doing. Even admirers and supporters of the European project, like me, have to admit that it has never had deep popular support or a lot of democratic legitimacy. It is instead an elite project so largely on the claim that there is no alternative, that it is the path of wisdom. And there is nothing like sustained poor economic performance, the kind of poor performance brought on by Europe's austerity and hard money obsessions, to undermine the elite's reputation for competence. That's probably why one recent study found a consistent historical relationship between financial crises and the rise of right-wing extremism. And history is repeating itself. The story is quite different in America because the Republican Party hasn't tried to freeze out the kind of people who vote National Front in France. Instead, it has tried to exploit them, mobilizing their resentment via dog whistles to win elections. This was the essence of Richard Nixon's Southern strategy and explains why the GOP gets the overwhelming majority of Southern white votes. And this is that is the partial truth, and it is no more than a partial truth. I would again note that this is the New York Times, and they are not talking about not only the profound corporate backing for fascism through the decades in the U.S. and in Europe, where there were no substantive changes in the corporate structure following World War II, and certainly totally absent from the analysis presented here is the Republican Ethnic Outreach Council, or Ethnic Heritage Outreach Council, which is quite literally a Nazi branch of the Republican Party, which is in turn the direct outgrowth of a covert operation which both sponsored fascist freedom fighters in Europe, Ukraine, Eastern Europe, and elsewhere under the CIA and OPC, but it also brought in thousands of Nazi collaborators, including SS, and installed them as a key part of the Republican Party. It was evolved from the 1948 presidential election. The godfather of that program was Alan Dulles, who was Thomas Dewey's 1948 campaign manager, and the fellow who was the chief implementer of the Crusade for Freedom was Richard Nixon. Its top spokesperson was Ronald Reagan. The person who handled the State Department machinations to bring these guys into the U.S. was William Casey. And when George H.W. Bush 1, was chairman of the Republican National Committee, he made the Nazi branch of the GOP a permanent branch of the GOP. It had previously been coalesced during on presidential election years. Ultimately, that covert operation resulted in the projection of these very same fascists into Eastern Europe following the fall of the Soviet Union. Ronald Reagan's Deputy Director of Public Liaison, Ekaterina Chumachenko, of the OUNB Ukrainian fascists who were allied with the Third Reich in World War II, she went on to become the First Lady of the Ukraine under Viktor Yushchenko. And the Minister of Justice in Ukraine was Roman Zvarich, the personal secretary of Yaroslav Stetsko, the head of the OUNB and the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. I've done a massive series of programs about the Ukraine and the reinstitution of the OUNB as a result of the Maidan coup. Most of those elements were actually projected into power as a result of the so-called Orange Revolution. I would also note that Viktor Yushchenko, just like Petro Poroshenko, visited the site of the Babi Yar massacre and laid a wreath of tribute to the OUNB, who comprised the bulk of the executioners in that famous Holocaust massacre.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
On Saturday, December 12th, the same day, on the same op-ed page that the Timothy Egan goose-steppers of the GOP ran, and the day after the Paul Krugman column, Empowering the Ugliness, ran, there was a column in the New York Times by Yvonne, I-V-A-N, Krastev, K-R-A-S-T-E-V, as in Victor. Poland's Illiberal Turn. And that was also titled, Why Poland is Turning Away from the West. And this one reads in part, during the recent electoral campaign in Poland, a constant question raised by pundits and politicians was not whether the country would go right, but whether it would go wrong. Would the conservative Law and Justice Party, the expected victors in the poll, go the way of Viktor Orban's increasingly authoritarian Hungary, or would it stay closer to the center? Given the nationalist, anti-liberal slant of the party's campaign platform, could Poland's seemingly consolidated liberal institutions reverse course? Law and justice won decisively, and after only 3 weeks, we have an answer. A distressing yes. Skipping down. Speaking not only of the Law and Justice Party, these populist and radical parties aren't just parties, they are constitutional movements. They promise voters what liberal democracy cannot, a sense of victory where majorities, not just political majorities, but ethnic and religious ones as well, can do what they please. The rise of these parties is symptomatic of the explosion of threatened majorities as a force in European politics. They blame the loss of control over their lives, real or imagined, on a conspiracy between cosmopolitan-minded elites and tribal-minded immigrants. They blame liberal ideas and institutions for weakening the national will and eroding national unity. Again, they are blaming the loss of control over their lives on the conspiracy between cosmopolitan-minded elites and tribal-minded immigrants. They blame liberal ideas and institutions for weakening the national will and eroding national unity. And the previous day, on the same day that the Paul Krugman column, Empowering Ugliness, appeared, that is Friday, December 11th of 2015, there was a very insightful op-ed column by Aatish, A-A-T-I-S-H, last name T-A-S-E-E-R, Taseer. It's called The Return of History. And what he does in this column is to sort of dolly the camera back. He takes a look at ISIS. He takes a look at India, where Narendra Modi's BJP party descended from the Hindu fascist RSS, or really controlled by the Hindu nationalist fascist group, the RSS. They are in power there. He talks about ISIS. And once again, the preoccupation with the past, the loss of control over people's lives, is giving rise to a populist sentiment fixated on an idealized mythical past, an atavism that aims to turn back the clock and to return to a time that really never in fact existed. That is why I called this program Machiavelli 3.0, because again, you've got the Law and Justice Party, you've got the Front National, you've got Donald Trump and others saying, you see, you can't trust these immigrants, you can't trust the Muslims, Muslim immigrants, whatever. We are your only hope. Join with us. And at the same time, you've got ISIS saying, you see, you can't trust these infidels, you will never be part of their society. We are your only hope. Join with us. And all of them are enjoying a tremendous degree of success. ISIS is recruiting on social media. is one of the things that is drawing so many people to their cause. But again, note that all of these analyses, this is, once again, the New York Times, fails to grasp the institutional links of all of these groups, corporatists, and the, in the case of Nazism, the eugenics philosophy that was very, very well established in the West and that had its embodiment in the Nazi extermination programs. But once again, I think this column is very important and it's going to set the stage for a reading, a rereading of some of Peter Levenda's text in just a minute. The Return of History by Atish Tazir. Again, New York Times, Friday, December 11th of 2015. And skipping down, talking about ISIS and a book by William McCants, W-I-L-L-I-A-M-M-C-C-A-N-T-S. William McCants is the author of the excellent new book, The ISIS Apocalypse, and he is nothing if not a student of living history. Mr. McCants looks at the Islamic State's idea of the past and how the group's adherents view their place in it. The picture that emerges is one of a terrific tension between the dead past and the ways in which it is being remade to fit the needs of the living present. The Islamic State's treatment of history is particularly extreme, but a similar return of history is occurring with varying degrees of intensity all across the old world. The jihadists in Syria and Iraq, Mr. McCants told me, are, quote, infatuated, unquote, with Harun al-Rashid, H-A-R-U-N-A-L-R-A-S-H-I-D, the great Abbasid caliph whose court reportedly inspired 1,001 knights. Quote, they see him as the pinnacle of success and the caliphate that he ruled over as the golden age, unquote, Mr. McCants said. But they elide all those parts of his rule that don't mesh with their own. The 8th century caliph being idolized by the Islamic State practiced a far more lenient rule than Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi does. Harun was tolerant of Shiites and religious minorities. His court would engage in free-willing debates over matters of faith. You could play musical instruments, unquote, Mr. McCants said. He loved to drink wine. He loved men, unquote. That the Islamic State has made violent use of history shouldn't come as a surprise. Perhaps more surprising is that in all those places where a modern nation has been grafted onto an ancient culture, history has returned with a vengeance. From Confucian China to Buddhist Myanmar to Hindu India, history has become the source of a fierce new conservatism that is being used to curb freedoms of women and stoke hatred of minorities. One more time. From Confucian China to Buddhist Myanmar to Hindu India, history has become the source of a fierce new conservatism that is being used to curb freedoms of women and stoke hatred of minorities. As the ultimate source of legitimacy, history has become a way for modernizing societies to procure the trappings of modernity while guarding themselves from its values. When I was in Sri Lanka in 2013, the Bodubala Senya, B-O-D-U-B-A-L-A-S-E-N-A, a radical Buddhist nationalist group had conjured up a prudish Buddha who scolded young girls about their clothes and told them what time they should be home at night. In reality, the Buddha, like many Eastern thinkers, was generally reticent on the subject of sexual morality. Sex concerned him only to the extent that it interfered with men realizing the fullness of their spiritual lives. Similarly, in India, a breach has appeared between a sensuous and liberal past and an ugly, puritanical present. In my daily reading of Sanskrit poetry, there are women with disheveled hair, half-open eyes, and cheeks covered in sweat from the exertion of coitus. But turn on the television, and the Minister of Culture, who says that the Hindu holy books are ideal texts for teaching moral values, informs modern Indians that, quote, girls wanting a night out, unquote, may be all right elsewhere, but it is, quote, not part of Indian culture, unquote. He seeks to cleanse Indian culture of the pollution of the West, but if it's sex the minister worries about, he'll have to cleanse Indian culture of itself. No one did it better than ancient India. The past is alive as it has never been before. It almost seems to serve as a kind of armor against an alien and impure present. And modernity, in the shallow sense of the word, that world of highways and blue glass malls and men in the uniforms of foreign companies, does not satisfy the demands for this living history, unquote. In fact, a certain dispiriting experience of modernity, felt often as the loss of a sense of self and of old ways, exacerbates these demands. This is what lies behind this violent need to reclaim history. We are called from the past and must make our home in the future. Again, this last sentence. In fact, a certain dispiriting experience of modernity, felt often as the loss of a sense of self and of old ways, exacerbates these demands. This is what lies behind this violent need to reclaim history. I would note that Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist fascism has been promoted by Pierre Omidyar of eBay, who also has been bankrolling Glenn Greenwald's financial ventures and Laura Poitras's, or journalistic ventures, rather. He also helped to finance the Maidan coup in Ukraine that brought to power the OUNB. Skipping down in the column here, that is the column by Atish Tasir. But the return of history is not specific to Islam. All over the old world, the spread of modernity and the wearing down of tradition have led to a frantic need to repossess the past. But this act of reclamation, through an ever closer adherence to text without context, does not give back what was lost. It creates something radical and new and dangerous. Now, this is quite correct. That's why I call this Machiavelli 3.0. Now, returning once again to the book, the remarkable book, The Hitler Legacy by Peter Lavenda. I've done a dozen interviews with Peter this year. And on pages 85 through 89, he talks about this dynamic. Both the American Nazi and the Klan movements wanted America to go back to the way it was before the Great Depression, before the First World War, to a time that never really existed in the way they thought it did, a time that never really existed at all, a time before the advent of communist states like the Soviet Union, a time before blacks and Jews could be considered equal citizens of the nation. Like many of today's extreme right protesters, the Nazis and Klansmen of the 1920s and the 1930s wanted, quote, to take their country back, unquote. In this case, and possibly in the present case also, back, unquote, meant back in time. This focus, after talking about the Nazi eugenics programs, Peter goes on to further discuss this dynamic. I would note, too, that powerful elements of the New Age, who will focus on Atlantis, or how what we were visited once long ago by space aliens who seeded humanity. Once again, a preoccupation with a mythical, idealized past that never existed. It is common to much of the New Age, much of which, frankly, I consider to be absolutely fascist. And it also is something that we see in many of the manifestations of fascism. Continuing with the Hitler legacy. After talking about the Nazi eugenics programs, this focus on purity could be seen as a desire to return to a more primitive time, in illo tempore, when the world was pristine. that this time probably never existed, did not occur, or was not acceptable to those promoting this return to nature, unquote, and return to our roots, unquote, philosophy. Legends of ancient Greece and Rome were conflated with legends concerning Atlantis and Thule, the latter the presumed ancient homeland of the Aryans. With the coming of Western civilization, according to this theory, much of humanity's basic goodness and inherent physical and psychic powers were lost, a kind of Samson and Delilah moment when the virile and pure Samson is shorn of his hair and thus loses his potency and strength to the Levantine Semitic seductress. It is also an implicit acknowledgement of failure. This yearning for a return to some other state in the distant past indicates an incapability of dealing with present-day issues in any other way. It represents a desire to wipe the slate clean and start over, which may be attractive as a fantasy, but not practicable in life.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
I would note, too, some of the things about Donald Trump. We don't have anywhere near enough time to really flesh out Donald Trump. I would note an article from the Washington Post of March 5th of 1985, Helena Fondon's Viennese Waltz by William Drudziak, D-R-U-D-Z-I-A-K. Is talking about Helena von Dahm. She is the protege of Otto von Bolsching. He was Adolf Eichmann's superior in administering the, quote, final solution, unquote, to the, quote, Jewish problem, unquote. Von Bolsching then became a Dulles protege, came over to the U.S. working for the CIA and the Galen Org, and his protege, Helena von Dahm, selected all of the personnel for Ronald Reagan's administration. She then became Reagan's ambassador to Austria. Speaking of Helena von Dahm, she would like to divide her time between Vienna and New York, where her campaign days reached several close friendships in big business circles, notably with construction magnate Donald Trump. So there you go. Trump is right in there with that whole crew. I first read about Donald Trump quite a few years ago. I was in a barbershop and was having my hair cut, and there were almost nothing but hunting and fishing magazines lying around. There was one old copy of Sports Illustrated. As it happened, it was the swimsuit issue, which is probably why it was still hanging around. This was late in the year. So I unstuck the pages and came across an article by about Donald Trump, who was in Sports Illustrated because he was the owner of the New Jersey Generals, who were a football team in a now-defunct football league. And this is from the USFL, the United States Football League's Trump Card by Robert Boyle, B-O-Y-L-E, from Sports Illustrated of February 13th of 2015. The USFL's Trump card. Skipping down. As might be expected, the Trumps travel in rarefied circles. Dr. Norman Vincent Peale is their pastor, Roy Cohn their attorney. Quote, Donald Trump is an extraordinary young man, says Peale. He has the elements of genius, unquote. Cohn says Trump is, quote, one of the most enterprising, ingenious businessmen on the American scene, a miracle man who can't seem to make a mistake even if he tries. And this, of course, is sanitized coverage. Dr. Norman Vincent Peale is best known for The Power of Positive Thinking. He was featured regularly in the Saturday Evening Post. Roy Cohn was Senator Joe McCarthy's right-hand man. And to give you a little bit of political depth about these two close associates of Donald Trump, one, Roy Cohn, his attorney, and Norman Vincent Peale, his pastor. We're going to use one of the books, we're going to excerpt here, one of the books that is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. From Undercover, My 4 Years in the Nazi World in America by John Roy Carlson, published by E.P. Dutton in 1943. Of Norman Vincent Peale, he was a frontman for an Axis spy named Edward James Runley, R-U-M-E-L-Y. From Undercover. Runley is the boss of the Committee for Constitutional Government and second in command to Frank E. Gannett, publisher of a string of newspapers and founder of the committee in 1937. As soon as the senatorial investigation was over, Runley literally went underground and erased his name from the committee stationery. But he continued to run it by appointing a docile Protestant clergyman as, quote, acting chairman and secretary, unquote, who visited the office only occasionally. He was the Reverend Norman Vincent Peale, once a joint speaker with American fascist Mrs. Elizabeth Dilling and Reverend Edward Lodge Curran, a key aide to Father Coughlin, at a pro-American mass meeting sponsored by more than 50 patriotic organizations at the Hotel Commodore in New York. Runley's friendship with Henry Ford dated prior to the summer of 1918, when Ford rushed to Washington in an unsuccessful attempt to save Runley from being indicted. And Roy Cohn, again, was the key aide to Senator Joe McCarthy during the McCarthy witch hunt of the early 1950s. In AFA program number 2, we took a look at the fact that two German Americans, Frank Sensenbrenner and Walter Harnischweiger, both of whom were sympathetic to Adolf Hitler, had bankrolled Joe McCarthy. And in For the Record program number 678, we took a look at one of the key sources of information used by Joe McCarthy in his anti-communist witch hunts. And that was a fellow named John Frenchy Grombach. Reading now from Blowback by Christopher Simpson. One of Grombach's most important assets, according to U.S. naval intelligence records obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, was SS General Karl Wolff, a major war criminal who had gone into the arms trade in Europe after the war. Grombach worked simultaneously under contract to the Department of State and the CIA. The ex-military intelligence man succeeded in creating, quote, one of the most unusual organizations in the history of the federal government, according to CIA Inspector General Lyman Kirkpatrick, quote, it was developed completely outside of the normal governmental structure, but it used all of the normal cover and communications facilities normally operated by intelligence organizations, and yet never was under any control from Washington. By the early 1950s, the U.S. government was bankrolling Grombach's underground activities to more than $1 million annually, skipping down. Grombach banked on his close connections with Senators Joseph McCarthy, William Jenner, and other members of the extreme Republican right to propel him to national power. Grombach's outfit effectively became the foreign espionage agency for the far right, often serving as the overseas complement to McCarthy's generally warm relations with J. Edgar Hoover's FBI at home. U.S. government contracts bankrolling a network of former Nazis and collaborators gave him much of the ammunition he needed to do the job. Grombach used his networks primarily to gather dirt. This was the American agent's specialty, his true passion, political dirt, sexual dirt, any kind of compromising information at all. Quote, he got into a lot of garbage pails, unquote, as Kirkpatrick puts it, and issued dirty linen, unquote, reports on Americans. Grumbach collected scandal, cataloged it, and used it carefully, just as he had done during the earlier McCormick investigation. He leaked smears to his political allies in Congress and the press when it suited his purposes to do so. Grumbach and congressional internal security investigators bartered those dossiers with one another almost as though they were boys trading baseball cards. So, a nice source of Joe McCarthy's information was the Pond, as it was called, by John Frederick Grumbach, financed by the U.S. government, and drawing on information provided by a network of former SS officers headed by SS General Karl Wolf, who was Heinrich Himmler's personal adjutant. And again, Roy Cohn, Donald Trump's attorney, was Joe McCarthy's top aide and inevitably deeply involved with all of these things. So the point being that how can anyone be, quote, shocked about what Donald Trump is doing? And although I think it is very important that, again, four op-ed columns, two on each of two successive days, Friday, December 11th, and Saturday, December 12th of 2015, talked about the rise of fascism in Europe and in America, the U.S. in particular, and in that very insightful column by Atish Tazir, talked about how the preoccupation with the mythical time in illo tempore was common to the rise of Islamic fascism of ISIS, the Hindu nationalist fascism of Narendra Modi, and also other reactionary movements as well. It is very similar to what drove the Nazis and the Klan in the pre-World War II and World War II periods. It is also what is driving the reaction today. So when you see Donald Trump hooked up with Helena Von Dahm, when you see him with Roy Cohn as his personal attorney, when you see him with Norman Vincent Peale as his personal pastor, you want to take a look at the men behind the curtain, although they're not really behind the curtain at all, because they are right there. And it should come as no surprise whatsoever that these things are going on. Again, please use the SpitfireList.com website, the books, the 36-plus years of audio and printed files that I put there, and this will flesh out in a way that I can't possibly do the background necessary to understand what is going on here. This concludes For the Record program number 882, The Perfect Storm, Machiavelli 3.0, and the Rise of Global Fascism. This is being recorded on December 18th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.